And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars. Hello, friends. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. I'm your host this week, Jerry Barrett. Now, I know I promised that Tex would be on the air with you this week, but he is so busy. I think he just likes me doing the show for him. I did talk to him. He came in the office for a little bit yesterday, and he promised that he will be here next week to give his special message for you. And I know you're disappointed that you don't get to listen to Tex this week, but I've got a humdinger of a show for you. I hope you enjoy it as much as I've enjoyed putting it together. We're going to title this one, The Destruction of the American Dream. And what led to this was all of the hubbub about the NFL players kneeling during the national anthem. Now, my grandfather was a frogman in World War II. My dad and one of his brothers was in the Air Force. My dad's other brother, my Uncle Mike, was in the Army during Vietnam. My uncle on my mom's side, Uncle Carl, was in the Navy. So there's quite a bit of military history in my family. And it bugs me to see these guys taking a knee during a national anthem. And I can't help but remember when Bush sent our troops over there with General Norman Schwarzkopf. And during the Super Bowl, Whitney Houston sang the national anthem. And there was more patriotism in the stands. It was a beautiful rendition of the national anthem. American pride was overflowing. But now, thanks to one Colin Kaepernick, who is a half-black, half-white young man, whose mom was 19, I believe, and she didn't think that she could properly raise a child, so she put him up for adoption, and he was adopted by two white parents with two other children. And I understand that he's got issues. He feels that there are things that need to be addressed, but I don't believe that doing it during the national anthem is a proper place, proper forum for that to happen. Yes, we have the First Amendment that gives us the right to free speech. But there are people out there who believe that free speech doesn't have consequences. And I was laughing with Tex about this yesterday. I said, Tex, if I were to go down the street and say, yeah, I'm Jerry from Power of Prophecy and XYZ, and I was rude and obscene and obnoxious and vulgar as a representative of Power of Prophecy, what would happen to me, Tex? He said, you'd be gone. Exactly. So there is free speech, but there are repercussions for this free speech. We'll get into that a little bit. But I believe that he picked the wrong place, the wrong forum to address his issue. But it got me thinking about the American dream. The American dream lured a lot of immigrants to this nation. And our Constitution was written such that those who had an idea that worked hard to achieve success, they were rewarded by the marketplace. Now, the actual quote in our Constitution is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, by legally protecting these values, the Founding Fathers set up a society that was very attractive to those aspiring to a better life. Now, the Constitution doesn't specify a lifestyle, nor does it define what happiness will look like. But you are rewarded for the amount of effort that you put forth. Now, today there seems to be a nasty tarnish upon this American dream. Like I said earlier, we've got millionaire athletes protesting during our national anthem, seemingly disrespecting everything our country has stood for. We also have George Soros's backed Antifa running around attempting to rewrite our Constitution by removing the First Amendment. They're basically anarchists. There are those that are driving a wedge between races, explicitly shaming some Americans for their so-called white privilege. White supremacy is thrown around like a hot potato. And there was even one columnist who dared to call Charles Barkley a white supremacist, because Charles said that the black people should worry about getting an education and getting a job. That makes Charles Barkley an NBA Hall of Famer, a man who many believe will run for governor in Alabama one day. But he's a white supremacist. Goodness gracious. Now, is there a Marxist campaign to transform America? You look at the present fervor that is out there to remove Confederate monuments and other symbols which offend certain groups in our society. This began in earnest back in 2015 after the murder of several black parishioners in a church in Charleston, South Carolina. But the movement dates back much longer. Its real origins go back to the 60s and early 70s. And the triumph of a form of what has been called cultural Marxism in our universities and our colleges. And as a result of the progressive transformation views of American history in our popular culture. If you recall, even into the late 50s, not only in our popular culture, but in most of the history taught in our schools and colleges, the South, and in particular, the Confederacy, were viewed with some respect, if not sympathy. If slavery was condemned, and not just in the North, but also in the South, still, in particular, the veterans of the tragic Confederate military odyssey were portrayed by Hollywood in such films as The Raid, Rocky Mountain, or Jesse James, as noble and heroic figures doing their duty. And Southern culture and society itself was seen considerably more nuanced and appreciated than today's rigid and universal damnation. In schools, classic histories by Avery Craven, William Dunning, Charles Sidnor, Francis Butler Simpkins and others were prominently used and taught in colleges. And the monumental 10-volume A History of the South, published by the LSU Press, seemed to offer the final word on discussions of the Southern past. Oh, but by the mid-1960s, newer historians, such as Kenneth Stamp, Stanley Elkins, and others, influenced a more leftist ideology and more concentration on the role of race, which soon dominated the writing of Southern and American history. The liberals got a hold of them in academia, and they slanted their views to portray the South in such a negative light. Now, the dominant narrative of these ideological academics was that race and racism had been and continued to be the central issues that affected, influenced, and determined the rest of American history. And the logic went that since the Old South was predominantly the Confederacy, it defended slavery and was then by definition racist. And the symbols and monuments that memorialized it in any positive way represented that racism and a racist past that needed to not only be reinterpreted, but cleansed. Oh, but the assault on the Confederate past and its visible artifacts, its flags, its monuments, its symbols, is clearly only the tip of the iceberg for these people. Those who wish to remove our monuments honoring General Lee, Jefferson Davis, and others have made it manifest that Lee, Andrew Jackson, and Beauregard are only the first step in a much larger and all-consuming campaign to thoroughly purify and radically transform American society. These people must be from Orwell's Ministry of Truth. They're just rewriting it. Now, a few weeks ago, a group in Durham, North Carolina, called the Workers' World Party, organized a violent demonstration and the destruction of the Confederate veterans' monuments in that university city. Like other groups, such as Antifa, Black Lives Matter, the Workers' World supporters call for the abolition of capitalism, disarming of the police and ICE agents, the fight for Marxist revolution, and the defense of Black Lives Matter. All symbols and reminders of white supremacy and racism must be eradicated and destroyed. Oh, but those symbols aren't limited to the Southern Confederacy, but encompass nearly all of this country's founders, most of its 19th century presidents and political leaders, its earliest discoverers and colonizers, in fact, its basic historic culture. I don't know who came up with this bright idea of Columbus Day becoming Indigenous People's Day. That is crazy. Columbus didn't even land in America. Oh, but we've turned him into a barbarian and a racist. It's as if the Democratic Party, nearly the entirety of the media, and huge swaths of the GOP frantically accept the narrative of racism as the central and dominant issue in American history, from which all else, all history, all events flow. Mainstream media will couch their views in language of supposed Christian love and charity and a desire for social justice. But in fact, mainstream media has swallowed this Marxist vision whole hog and turned its back on historic traditional Christian belief and on our historical and cultural legacy. Mainstream media uses this public forum to advance the longer-range program of destruction, defamation, and a complete transformation of what is left of our American nation. They're destroying America. Now, these pawns of the revolution are just useful idiots, and up to a certain point, they will be discarded as having fulfilled their purposes. Now, for the rest of us who demonstrate that to destroy Confederate symbols opens the door wide to the destruction of all our symbols and the radical Marxist redefinition of the American nation, Lord have mercy on us. Wow. It's even infiltrated our colleges, our universities. Have an article here from townhall.com. Pennsylvania State University, Brandywine campus, Professor Angela Putman recently asserted in an academic paper that the notion of, if I work hard, I can be successful, is merely a product of white ideology. Professor Putnam conducted a study to critique and examine ideologies within college students' discourse that are foundational to whiteness. Her resulting conclusion, published on last Thursday, was that meritocracy, or the belief that people should rise based on the fruits of their own labor, is a white ideology. And in her mind, this white ideology is unfortunately widely accepted in academia. She believes that it's somehow a bad thing to teach students personal responsibility. Emphasizing a collective mindset, Putnam puts forth the idea that Americans are falsely socialized to believe that we got to where we are because of our own individual efforts. Sounds like Obama, doesn't she? You didn't build that company. America built that company. The federal government built that company. We have slidden down the rabbit hole, ladies and gentlemen, and it is not pretty. She goes on to claim that this ideology perpetuates whiteness and racism throughout society. Once students learn more about white ideology, they will hopefully resist perpetuating the whiteness through their own discourse and interactions and challenge systemic manifestations of racism and whiteness. Until students learn the hidden dangers of believing in the value of hard work and a positive attitude, whiteness ideologies may be reproduced through a general acceptance and unchallenging of norms, as well as through everyday discourse from a wide variety of racial positionalities. Now, this same woman has put forth even more radical ideas in the past. In a blog that she owns, she wrote, "Attend protests and rallies, but not if you aren't willing to be arrested." She says, "Those who led the fight for civil rights and those who continue to fight today believe so strongly in what they were fighting for that they were willing to be arrested or tear gassed or beaten by police if it came to that." She says, "When confrontation with law officers occurs, white people should be the ones at the front of the line, holding their ground and forcing officers to arrest them first. Let the media start writing headlines and talking on television about the countless white people arrested at the recent Black Lives Matter protest, and perhaps we might change the perceptions and shift the conversations people are having about this movement." Now, she didn't say how she would be grading these students in the future. So according to her theory, grading based on merits and test scores would be a perpetuation of the white ideological privilege. So she's being a racist. She's saying, in essence, all other races do not believe in hard work. Apparently, she possesses the belief that minorities are incapable of competing based on merit, a view which disparages the ability of non-whites. Now, there's an organization in America that shares her same beliefs. It's called the KKK. Now, when she says the belief that people should rise based on the fruits of their own labor is a white ideology, just remember, the belief that people should rise based on the fruits of others' labor is called communism. I wonder if this professor, so-called, realizes it. But her salary is subsidized and supported by high tuitions that hardworking people are paying so their kids can get an education. The destruction of America happening on college campuses. This white shaming is going on all across the country. It seems to be the new rage on college campuses. It seems that there's a professor at the University of Iowa who has pledged to expose her students to their own white ignorance in a peer-reviewed academic journal that she put out, and was stunned and appalled that she was criticized for it. Now, this professor, well, she's an assistant professor. Let me clarify. An assistant professor at the University of Iowa. Her name is Jody Lindley. She's an education instructor. And she wrote that her goal was to make her mostly white graduate students keenly aware of their white privilege and use her classroom to deconstruct whiteness. If she does otherwise, she explains, it would make her complicit in perpetrating white supremacy. She says white students talking about race with an all-white group of peers reveals their own white ignorance. Now, she says that this became an idea to her when she became a professor in 2014. And she resolved to develop courses that would both unveil and reject the notion that neutrality and objectivity are realistic and attainable. Her job, she claims, with white graduate students who will become higher education leaders, is to dismantle whiteness in her curriculum, assignments, and pedagogy. She explained, noting that in addition to her white identity, she also draws on her identities as a queer, able-bodied, cisgender woman with a working-class background to construct her teaching paradigm. So she's a queer. Goodness gracious. She can't even say that she's a woman. She's a cisgender woman. Well, she's definitely no lady. Ladies aren't queer. She goes on to say, for white students, talking about race with an all-white group of peers facilitates the realization that they are raced beings, thus revealing their own white ignorance. Now, it seems that Lindley and her university thought the paper would be groundbreaking work and would be met with universal praise. Daniel Clay, the dean of the College of Education, expressed horror over the criticism. He issued this statement, quote, recently, one of our faculty members was singled out for publishing a peer review article on race issues in higher education. This faculty member was targeted, harassed, and threatened by many people from around the country through email, phone calls, and social media. As the dean of our University of Iowa College of Education, I want to affirm that we welcome all students, faculty, and staff of all races and backgrounds. We work hard to create an inclusive environment that cultivates respect and appreciation for everyone. The University of Iowa is also strongly committed to freedom of expression and the First Amendment, and that extends to students, faculty, and staff. But why would you feel that criticism isn't a First Amendment right of those who are criticizing this goofy professor? You can't have your cake and eat it too, Dean Clay. This also happened last year. Portland Community College devoted an entire month to whiteness shaming. Georgia State University, an assistant professor, also published an academic journal article lamenting the insidiousness of silence and whiteness on college campuses. Last spring, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee called for the complete abolition of whiteness, saying only then will America see an end to racism. You know what all these professors had in common? They were white. Oh, me oh my. Now, Kaepernick's protest of the national anthem, you know, he started by sitting. And then a Green Beret that attended the University of Texas at Austin, played football here in Austin, and then played professionally for the Seattle Seahawks. He had a cup of coffee in the NFL. Talked to Kaepernick. And as a former military man, he said sitting on the bench is disrespectful. And I guess he compromised with Kaepernick and told him to take a knee. You know, there's a picture of this. If you Google it, you'll see. Kaepernick's taking a knee and Nate Boyer is standing right beside him. Nate's standing for the national anthem. Now, did you know that the Star Spangled Banner became part of our sports traditions for a good reason? It brought people together in times of grave national turmoil. For this reason alone, it's worth respecting this tradition. The Star Spangled Banner was first performed at a baseball game, May 15, 1862. And this is likely the first time it was played at a major U.S. sporting event. Now, the timing's significant in that 1862, our nation was embroiled in the Civil War. America was as divided as it had ever been. People were fighting and lives were being lost in battle. This truly was a dark time in our still young country. Now, a businessman named William Kammeyer was opening Union Grounds Park in Brooklyn and decided to do something to bring the nearly 3,000 people in attendance at this first game together and unify them as Americans. The band played Star Spangled Banner. Now, it wasn't officially the national anthem yet, but it was still respected and deeply patriotic. And it's a uniquely American song. Now, during World War I, 56 years later, our nation's once again in turmoil. Major League Baseball had to cut the season short because so many players were drafted or enlisted to go fight in the Great War overseas. Now, during the seventh inning stretch of the first game of the 1918 World Series between the Boston Red Sox and the Chicago Cubs, the Star Spangled Banner was performed, and it had a profound impact on both the crowd and the players. The New York Times reported, quote, "The yawn was checked and the heads were bared as the ballplayers turned quickly about and faced the music. Jackie Fred Thomas of the U.S. Navy," he was a Red Sox third baseman, "was at attention as he stood erect with his eyes set on the flag fluttering at the top of the lofty pole in right field." Now, first the song was taken up by a few, but then others joined in. And when the final notes came, a great volume of melody rolled across the field. It was at the very end that the onlookers exploded into thunderous applause and rent the air with a cheer that marked the highest point of the day's enthusiasm. Now, historically, the Star Spangled Banner has been part of the shared story of all Americans. It's a common thread that stitches our nation together in times of danger, pain, or triumph. We come together, stand, and sing, because despite all of our differences, we're still Americans. Oh, but day by day, the left tries to undermine and destroy the things that have historically unified our country. The current NFL national anthem controversy is just the latest example. Now, will the NFL succumb to the pressure and try to sidestep this problem and no longer play the national anthem before its games? This would be a horrific mistake. As a nation, we need to have a serious debate. Will we renew our patriotism and respect our shared history? Or will we allow American institutions to decay? Are we to ignore our traditions out of fear of ridicule from the left? Or are we going to proudly continue to be the land of the free and the home of the brave? Eric Nickischer worked at Buffalo's New Era Field for nearly 30 years before Sunday. Yep. He walked out of the stadium for good after seeing Bills players protest the national anthem. Nickischer said on Fox and Friends, "After the anthem ended, I took off my Buffalo Bills hat, threw it on the ground, took off my security shirt, and walked out." Nickischer said he has family members who are disabled veterans, and their sacrifice is what the anthem represents to him. His father, a career war veteran, was in tears with pride after Nickischer quit. He said, "The anthem is something I hold dear to my heart. I stood up for veterans and I did the right thing." The former security guard vowed never to set foot in the stadium again, nor watch an NFL game until the protests end. Nickischer said he's received a lot of support for his decision, including from Gold Star mothers. He recommended to the players that they go out into the community and try to solve problems rather than simply kneeling and say, "There's a problem. Someone else needs to fix it." Good for you, sir. Well, that takes care of the first half. This is Jerry Barrett hosting Power of Prophecy. We'll be right back after this brief message. I hope you're having a good time listening to this. It's been educational for me, and I appreciate you tuning in and listening to Power of Prophecy. We'll be right back after this brief message. They each took a solemn oath never to reveal the innermost secrets of the order. They have labored for centuries to hide their sick, murderous deeds. They have their own strange, diabolical language. Their language, in reality, is a type of hidden code, cloaked in enigmatic body gestures, hand signs, handshakes, tokens, grips, and symbols. Up to now, no one had been able to unravel the true meaning of this fiercely guarded hidden code of deception. Their leaders laughed at the feeble attempts of many who tried. Well, they won't be laughing anymore. Codex Magica smashes down the doors of secrecy and deceit. Now, with this book in hand, you can crack the Illuminati code wide open. These evil men, and not a few women, have plundered the earth and despoiled America for far too long. Awesome in scope, Codex Magica contains over 1,000 actual photographs and illustrations. You'll see with your own eyes the world's leading politicians, financiers, and celebrities, including America's richest and most powerful, caught in the act as they perform occult magic. Once you understand their covert signals and coded picture messages, your world will never be the same. You will know the truth about the Illuminati and their astonishing plan to control and manipulate. Everything will become clear. Now, as Tex Mars was investigating literature, art, archaeology of ancient mystery religions of Babylon, Egypt, Rome, Greece, Asia Minor, Central and South America, he was drawn to the manner in which ancient deities were depicted in art and stone displaying mysterious body gestures and hand signs. His study of the magical rituals of the mystery religions was also enlightening. It revealed how very influential these symbols and hieroglyphic marks were to Satan's high priests of old. Tex realized that these same mysterious but distinctive hand signs, handshakes, gestures, marks, and symbols are being employed today. They're employed by powerful politicians, bankers, and celebrities. The power elite of the Illuminati around the globe are imitating the ancients. Here is indisputable proof that the prophecies of the Bible are assuredly being fulfilled. Mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of harlots, and abominations of the earth, is alive. Codex Magica is the first book ever to crack the Illuminati code. It's fully documented and an authoritative reference source, as you'll see from the lengthy index and footnote section. You'll discover the biggest and most shocking collection of names and pictures of Illuminists and Illuminati sympathizers ever found in one volume. From Lord Rothschild, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Jacques Chirac. You'll be amazed to see pictures of Seinfeld TV show characters clearly giving the sign of El Diablo, and Leonard Nimoy of Star Trek displaying the Jewish Kabbalistic sign of Shin, disguised as the enigmatic sign of the mythical Vulcan race. You'll know why Pat Robertson is pictured giving a Masonic hand sign on the cover of Time magazine. You'll also learn why the Oval Office of the White House displays two different great seals of the United States, each having an eagle facing in the opposite direction. Codex Magica is an overwhelming 624 pages long and is in a large format book with over 1,000 illustrations and photos. The evidence amassed in this book is breathtaking and convincing. Anyone who dares to open up and examine even a tiny portion of this encyclopedic work will, I believe, be forced to concede that, yes, there is an Illuminati conspiracy. The elite core of this gargantuan conspiracy do, in fact, covertly communicate in their own sinister language of hand signs, handshakes, body gestures, and symbols. The elitists of the Illuminati are today an overpowering threat and force for evil in America and the whole world. The insidious, ages-old plan of the Illuminati is a clear and present danger to our liberties, our lives, our eternal souls. They must be stopped, and soon, before it's too late. Codex Magica, 624 pages, it's only $35. Please add $5 for shipping and handling to make a total of $40. You can send a check or money order or cash to Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, that's Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. Or you can go to our webpage, powerofprophecy.com. Powerofprophecy.com. It's right there on the homepage. There'll be a link underneath the streaming radio section. There's also a picture of the cover on the right-hand side of the webpage. Just scroll down. You'll find it. You click that. It'll take you right to the shopping cart. You can use your Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express in our secure shopping cart. Or you can phone us toll-free. Canada and the U.S. won't cost you a dime. Call us at 1-800-234-9673. Again, that number is 1-800-234-9673. I urge you to get the copy of this book if you don't have one already. It is a fantastic resource that you truly need to have for your library. Okay, let's return to our regular program. We're talking about the destruction of the American dream today. And we're in the middle of talking about the NFL protest by the NFL players taking a knee during a national anthem, disrespecting our country, our military, the men who fought and died, and women who have fought and died so that they can be paid millions of dollars to play a game on national TV. Well, many fans are upset with the players refusing to stand. Some have even decided to respond with demonstrations of their own. One fed-up Indianapolis Colts fan and a Marine veteran burned his season tickets and posted the video on Facebook, and it's quickly gone viral. Well, good for you. He said, "I've loved the NFL, always have. I've always been a huge fan. I wish I could have played in the NFL. Instead, I went into the Marine Corps. I served my country. My grandfather served our country. Both of them served in World War II. There's a lot of people that fought and died for that flag. And to disrespect it like you did, I'm done." That was Rodney Hurd, and he said that just before he dropped his booklet of season tickets into a fire pit. Now, Hurd told Fox Business Network on Wednesday that when he saw 10 Colts players kneeling for the anthem before Sunday's game, he was so angry he couldn't stay for the entire game. Hurd said, "Thousands of people died for our freedom. And I don't think it's much to ask for people to stand up and honor those that died so we can have that freedom." Got an article from Larry Horst on Punching Bag News. He wrote, "NFL controversy is much ado about nothing." Well, it seems that there are three sides that are engaged in conflict with each other, even though they may not have any reason to be in conflict at all. That's because they are all championing different and unrelated causes. Horace says the latest round seems to have started when Kaepernick remained seated, later kneeling, for the national anthem as a protest against a number of highly reported shootings of young black men by white police officers. Some see the protest as much broader, about allegations of pandemic white racism throughout American society. Virtually every good American would agree that racism should be protested and eliminated where it exists. So why the controversy? It is because of the form and place of protest. The sports arena is one of the great unifying locales in our republic. At any one time, tens of thousands of people of all backgrounds come together peacefully to enjoy the game, divided only by the loyalty to one team or another. It's entertainment. It's meant to be an escape from the more serious matters of life. The second mistake is disrespecting the national anthem as the means of protest. Since the anthem represents the totality of America as a people and culture, one cannot effectively use it as an instrument of narrow protest. The anthem doesn't represent one faction, one philosophy, one viewpoint, or even one problem. the marvel of America is that we are a nation that can respect our national culture and the many good qualities of our culture while still dealing with the imperfections and disagreements within our union. The very ability to do that is what we celebrate in the anthem, the flag, and the Pledge of Allegiance. The anthem also represents all those individuals from the Revolutionary War to the contemporary sands of the Sahara who died in defense of our freedom. Their lives resonate with each note of the Star-Spangled Banner. It's foolish to believe that one can disrespect the anthem without degrading their ultimate contribution and defending the loved ones they left behind or those who patriotically appreciate their sacrifice. Those who are now condemning the athletes' actions are not defending or endorsing racism. What the protesters claim is the purpose of their action is not what most Americans see. Those offended by the disrespect for the anthem are not opposing the message the athletes believe they are sending out. They are not opposing the fight against racism, but only what seems to be contempt for America. Now, I don't know about you, but my house has been boycotting the NFL for 2 years now. My wife put her foot down, and I'm not a big fan of the NFL. It lost its luster when I became a football official, and the state of Texas and the state of Massachusetts are the only two states in the union that use the NCAA rulebook. Well, when I became an official, I became more interested in the college game because the rules apply to my work on Friday night with the high school kids. So I just DVR a bunch of college games, and my wife lets me watch them on Sunday. She is a saint. Now, if you're out there watching the NFL, I'm sure that you haven't seen the people in the stands booing during these protests. Do you know why? The NFL has ordered the cameramen to ignore them. That's right. From conservative alerts, networks who've paid millions for the rights to air NFL games are taking a massive hit in the wallet as viewers are turning off the tube in droves, leaving advertisers demanding refunds. And now it's gotten so bad in the stadiums that networks have ordered camera operators not to take wide-angle shots of the crowds during the national anthem to avoid showing how many of them are booing the players and coaches for kneeling. At the end of the day, whether sports or elections, one thing remains true. The American people still call the shots. Now, if you listen closely, you can hear fans booing loudly as the players knelt or sat during the anthem. You can even hear shouts of "stand up." Oh, but the anthem protesters just got some very bad news. It started in Louisiana. State Representative Kenny Heffert was outraged over the New Orleans Saints' anti-American protest. He announced his intention to introduce legislation to cut off the public funding for the Saints. The very reason the Saints have the privilege and opportunity to play professional football while being paid millions is because someone in uniform died protecting their right to do so, Heffert said. It is a disgrace to the men and women of this nation and state who have sacrificed so much. Heffert's statement didn't specify the amount of state money that he proposed be diverted from the Saints. According to a 2015 Forbes story, Saints owner Tom Benson was set to rake in an estimated $392 million from state subsidies through 2025. Heffert said disrespecting our national anthem and flag in the name of social injustice is the highest form of hypocrisy. Good for you, Senator. Now, we know Black Lives Matter has been out there protesting, but they haven't been protesting in the places I think they need to be. Why not outside Planned Parenthood? Among black women, 30% of black pregnancies end in abortion. Among white women, less than 11% of white pregnancies end in abortion. The abortion ratio among Hispanic women is 15% of pregnancies. That translates approximately to 497 Hispanic children, 941 black children, and 967 white children every day. More blacks are killed by abortion each year in the United States than by all other causes combined. The majority of Planned Parenthood's abortion clinics are located in communities with minority populations. Planned Parenthood's founder, Margaret Sanger, is documented as saying, "We do not want the word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population." Wow. So we're talking about racism. What does the Bible say about racism? The first thing to understand in this discussion is that there is only one race, the human race. All human beings have the same physical characteristics, with minor variations, of course. But more importantly, all human beings are equally created in the image and likeness of God. God loved the world so much that he sent Jesus to lay down his life for us. The world obviously includes all ethnic groups. God does not show partiality or favoritism, and neither should we. James 2, verse 4, describes those who discriminate as judges with evil thoughts. Instead, we are to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. All forms of racism, prejudice, and discrimination are affronts to the work of Christ on the cross. Jesus commands us to love one another as he loves us. If God is impartial and loves us with impartiality, then we need to love others with the same high standard. Now, racism in varying forms and to various degrees has been a plague to humanity for thousands of years. Victims of racism, prejudice, and discrimination need to forgive. Ephesians 4, verse 32 declares, "Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you." Racists may not deserve your forgiveness, but we deserve God's forgiveness far less. And I love the book of Galatians. Galatians 3, verse 28 says, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Now, we've talked about white shaming, white supremacy, racism, the fact that Planned Parenthood is killing more black babies than anything else. But are you aware that there's a progressive assault on the American Constitution? That's right. Many of the left call themselves progressives today. They call themselves progressive instead of liberal because they very much intend to revive the political principles of America's original progressives from the progressive era of the 1880s through World War I. For example, Mrs. Clinton, when asked during a 2008 presidential debate if she was a liberal, rejected the label and instead claimed a connection to America's original progressives from the turn of the 20th century. So why would leftist politicians like Clinton purposely identify themselves with this progressive movement? The reason is that America's original progressives were also its original big government liberals. Most people point to the New Deal era as the source of big government and the welfare state that we have today. While this is perfectly accurate, it is important to understand that the principles of the New Deal did not originate in the New Deal. Rather, they came from the progressives who had dominated American politics and intellectual culture a generation prior to the New Deal. Now, who made up the progressive movement? Some of these names will be familiar, others less so. How about Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, John Dewey, or Herbert Crowley? Crowley was the founder and the first editor of the New Republic, which became the main organ of progressive opinion in the United States and is still one of the most important journals on the left today. These progressives wanted a thorough transformation in America's principles of government, from a government permanently dedicated to securing individual liberty to one whose ends and scope would change to take on any and all social and economic ills. Now, our founders understood that our national government must have the capacity to be strong and vigorous. They also were very clear that this strength must always be confined to very limited ends or areas of responsibility. Government, in other words, while not weak or tiny, was to be strictly limited. The progressive conception of government, on the other hand, was quite the opposite. Progressives had an evolving or a living notion of government. Yep, we get the term living constitution from the progressives. They wanted government to take on whatever role and scope the times demanded. The progressives reasoned that the people of the founding era may have wanted a limited government, given their particular experience with King George III, but they argued that people of their own time wanted a much more activist government and that we should adjust accordingly. Quite simply, the progressives detested the bedrock principles of American government. They also detested the Declaration of Independence, which enshrines the protection of individual natural rights. They detested the Constitution, which places permanent limits on the scope of government and is structured in a way that makes the extension of national power beyond its original purpose very difficult. If the progressives wanted to disregard the Constitution in order to vastly enlarge the scope of government, how, as a practical matter, was this to be done? It happened in a variety of ways, but principal among them was a fundamental change in the American presidency. Under the system of our founders, government was to have sufficient strength and energy to accomplish its ends, but those ends were strictly limited by the Constitution. The principal way in which the Constitution keeps the government within its boundaries is through the separation of powers. Woodrow Wilson hated the separation of powers for precisely this reason. It made the government inefficient and made it difficult, if not impossible, to expand the power of government so that it could take on all of the new tasks those progressives had in mind. So, they looked to the presidency as a way of getting around this obstacle and having instead a living constitution. Under the original system, the president was merely leader of a single branch or part of the government, and thus could not provide leadership of the government as a whole. Wilson urged leadership and control must be lodged somewhere. Wilson pointed out the president was the only politician who could claim to speak for the people as a whole, and thus he called upon the president to rise above the separation of powers, to consider himself not merely as chief of a single branch of government, but as the popular leader of the whole national politics. Wilson believed the original intention of the separation of powers system could be circumvented, and the enhanced presidency could be a means energizing the kind of active national government that the progressive agenda required. Now, since the progressives had such a limitless view of state power, and since they wanted to downplay the founders' emphasis on individual rights, it's only natural to ask if they subscribed to socialism. First, we must be clear. The relationship of progressivism and socialism are similar in the philosophy of government. Second, we must also bear in mind that there was an actual socialist movement during the progressive era, and prominent progressives such as Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt were critics of it. In fact, Wilson and Roosevelt both ran against a socialist candidate in the 1912 election. The progressives were ambivalent about the socialist movement of their day, not so much because they disagreed with it in principle, but because the American socialist movement was a movement of the lower classes. The progressives were elitists. They looked down their noses at the socialists. Both progressivism and socialism championed the prerogative of the state over the rights of the individual. Wilson himself made this connection very plain in a revealing essay he wrote in 1887 called Socialism and Democracy. Wilson begins this essay by defining socialism, explaining that it stands for unfettered state power, which trumps any notion of individual rights. It proposes that all ideas of a limitation of public authority by individual rights be put out of view. Wilson also, after putting down socialism, explains that he finds nothing wrong with it in principle, since it was merely the logical extension of genuine democratic theory. It gives all the power to the people in their collective capacity to carry out their will through the exercise of governmental power, unlimited by any undemocratic idea like individual rights. Teddy Roosevelt, too, argued for a new conception of government, where individual natural rights would no longer serve as a principled boundary that the state was prohibited from crossing. He called in his new nationalism program for the state to take an active role in effecting economic equality by way of superintending the use of private property. Private property rights, which have been serving as a brake on the more aggressive progressive policy proposals, were to be respected. Roosevelt argued only insofar as the government approved of the property's social usefulness. He wrote, "We grudge no man a fortune in civil life if it is honorably obtained and well used. It is not even enough that it should have been gained without doing damage to the community. We should permit it to be gained only so long as the gaining represents benefit to the community. This, I know, implies a policy of a far more active governmental interference with social and economic conditions in this country than we have yet had. But I think we have got to face the fact that such an increase in governmental control is now necessary." There are important connections between America's original progressive era and the crisis we are facing today, and it's useful to consider these connections on two levels. The first connection is at a general level and concerns our abandonment of the Constitution. The present crisis did not appear out of nowhere and didn't simply begin with the election of Barack Obama. Politicians of both parties spent the better part of the 20th century disregarding the Constitution as they looked to have government step up to solve every conceivable human problem. Thus, it ought to be no surprise that the Constitution's limits on government aren't even part of the conversation today as our politicians debate the new interventions in our economy and society that seem to come daily. Such a state of things would have greatly pleased America's original progressives. Progressives believed that the role of government should be determined not by our Constitution, but by whatever the needs of the day happen to be. This is why they sought to eradicate talk of the Constitution from our political discourse. Today, that goal seems to be realized. The second connection between the original progressive era and our situation today has to do with policy. The progressives knew that our original system of government was not capable of handling all the new tasks that they had in mind for it. So they envisioned creating a vast set of bureaucratic agencies. Now, I want to call us all together. You know, to be labeled as the world's last superpower, we surely are a splintered and divided nation. We've segregated ourselves from one another, be it by race, be it by economic standard, or any other instrument of division. We seem to have lost the luster that made America great, that called the tired, the poor, the huddled masses to our shores. Those professional athletes who refused to stand for the national anthem, the blustery rhetoric coming from Hollywood about our president, the liberal slant from our educational system, the mainstream media, and the publishing houses are all fomenting dissent and discord among Americans. We all need to remember that we are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Our Constitution claims that all men are created equal. Have we forgotten this? I found this quote in Romans 13, verse 8 through 10. "Owe no man anything but to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. For this, thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law." Now, don't forget, Tex will be back on the air next week with a special message for everyone. Please be sure to tune in. I'm Jerry Barrett, and I appreciate you listening. My prayer is you'll tune in next week at the same time. Tune in and discover the power of prophecy.